Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast seeks to bring together the worlds of academia and professional practice. If you're interested in the latest research and trends in sport, then this is the podcast for you. Today, I'm joined by Jamie Taylor and Richard Allen. Jamie is a coach and coach developer who works predominantly with Olympic and Paralympic sports, along with Premier League football academies. He is also the former head coach of Leicester Tigers Academy, a performance rugby coach at Loughborough University, and in the final stages of a PhD at Edinburgh University. Richard Allen has worked at all levels of football in a variety of roles, from grassroots through to international level, running a youth organisation in one of the country's most challenging city boroughs, to being responsible for the identification, recruitment, development and selection of players at Tottenham Hotspurs, Queen's Park Rangers and the England national team. He is currently Director of Football at Loughborough University, where he's responsible for managing and leading the entire football department. We're going to discuss why some of the best players never make it, and what clubs can do to try to better support player development. Hi Jamie, hi Rich, thanks for coming on.
Hi Martin, nice to be here.
Hi Martin and Rich, good to be on.
So what we're going to mainly focus on today, we're going to have a look and a chat about talent ID, and more specifically, we're going to look at why these high potential players sometimes don't make it. I know you've both worked in this for a while, and Jamie, I know you've got some research that's published recently. So can you shed some light on what your research has told us? Then we'll get into the practicalities of your guys' experience.
Yeah, thank you. So we've recently had a paper published between myself and co-author Dave Collins, and we took two cohorts of coaches, rugby coaches, football coaches, and asked them to think of the three players who they felt were dead certs for future success. Those are the highest potential, but yet ended up falling away. And they identified a number of reasons why these players were unable to fulfill the potential that people thought that they had. And a number of factors were considered. So we looked at, such as serendipity, wrong place, wrong time, just ending up with some bad luck, failures of the talent development system, not offering the right opportunities at the right time, and maladaptive family input, which effectively was input from family members that caused problems for the progression of the player, a lack of physical skills, which was a small factor, and then finally, the most important and most prevalent factor was a lack of psychological skills.
So have you got, and I see from your research, you've got quite a lot of practical examples around them. I think we're going to mainly focus upon the psychological side, but feel free to have any chats on in regards to your practical experience around any of those other factors as well. So you said psychological. So what specifically have you found that has been the problem?
So in the paper, a variety of different things were highlighted, but effectively what we know about a talent development journey is that it's very unlikely to be linear. That is, a player or an athlete moves from A to B to C to D in a nice straightforward way. And not only that, but we also believe that it's undesirable for somebody to progress in that nice, easy way. We want people to experience a challenge-full pathway. Now, one of the things that's identified in this paper is that in order to navigate that and to make the most of the challenges that you're faced with, you need to be highly committed, highly motivated, and also have the coping skills that are required to face up to the challenges that are put in front of you.
So what kind of things have you seen, Rich, in terms of that? Do you agree with that in football? Have you seen that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem with talent ID is that it's highly complex. It's really difficult. And often it's more about looking back and understanding things than probably realizing it at the time. So, yeah, certainly as much as I think people funnily make some mistakes about, you know, what a player's headroom for growth is, I don't just mean physically, I just mean across the board, and sometimes you just get it wrong, and you know, factors like relative age effect and maturation kick in, especially when in football you're looking at recruiting players at under nines for their first registration. That means you're looking at players at 6, 7, 8 in your pre-academy. It's kind of fraught with danger. I've always thought, you know, and it's kind of a big statement, that the kind of the difference between good and great is all the psychosocial kind of behaviors and characteristics which we're talking about. And then I suppose you have to talk about, you know, what do you need to do along the way to make sure that either those things happen. Sometimes it happens naturally. Sometimes you may have to come up with some interventions to prepare them and get them to a place where they need to be.
So have we got some examples then, Jamie, from the research that says specifically, so, you know, run us through an example of what the actual problem was with this?
Without I suppose going into real depth on a particular individual, because I don't want to compromise confidentiality. But there are examples here of a very gifted young rugby player who progressed rapidly, effectively too good to play academy rugby from a physical standpoint and from a technical standpoint. But as soon as it got tough at the first exposure to the first team level, because he hadn't been challenged previously and perhaps because he lacked the commitments in order to keep pushing on when things got tough, he ended up falling out of the pathway. And now, knowing who this player is, they're no longer even playing the game of rugby, from being perceived as one of the brightest young talents in England.
So are we talking that this generally happens from that academy stage, as in 16s, 18s, stepping into the pro game? Is this when this real problem starts to occur?
I think that's obviously very sport dependent. Where in rugby, yes, it does appear that there's a particular, I suppose, challenge point post 18. And one of the things that's also identified in this paper is that for rugby players, a steep step change in challenge takes place post 18, because there aren't really that many levels in rugby that you can. There aren't many levels you can be pushed up to in rugby, whereas in football, there is always somewhere typically for a young player to go to get more challenge. That's a little bit more restricted in rugby. It's very contextual, very sport-based, but effectively, it's the point at which it gets tough that these types of resources get tested. And if a young player doesn't develop the skills they require earlier in their journey or isn't exposed to this challenge in their journey, it leaves them at risk.
Have you found something similar in football? And I know we chatted earlier, and if you're happy to name drop, Rich, we will go for it. Don't worry if not.
Yeah, and it does. And again, you know, as I say, it's problematic when you're starting off in football so young. But I guess if you look, and a couple of years ago, I went in and did kind of almost like a black box kind of exercise at Tottenham, and looking back at, you know, why did we sign this player? Didn't sign this player? Why did this one work? Why did this one work? All the different scenarios. And I guess, you know, again, maybe more luck than judgment, somebody like Harry Kane, who's obviously come through and become incredibly successful, you know, released at a young age from a big club. So he was released at Arsenal, came into us, struggled on many different levels because of, you know, issues around maturation. He's very young. He's a July birthday, early July. So he's very young in the group, almost up for kind of, you know, being released every year. Even at the top end, when he went out on loan, you know, clearly had something, but struggled through some of his loan periods, and then suddenly breaking into the first team and pushing on from there. Now, I would suggest that all of those experiences that he had has led him to be the person he is now. His drive, his determination, his, you know, absolute desperation to be successful, you know, complete obsessive around what he does and how he trains. So real characteristics, I guess. The next bit is around where you get to the very top end, where it's, you know, what we would have described as delivering when it counts. Something we used at the FA, you know, Messi, when it really matters, will score the winning goal. Ronaldo will always step up in the big match. Can Harry do that? And then if we look at the other end, you know, I was very heavily involved in signing John Bostock, and I love John. I'm glad he's still doing well. But John was considered to be the best, you know, he was going to be the best player in the world. And maybe part of the issue that he had was, you know, his time at Crystal Palace, he was just always the best player. He was considered the best player. He was told he was the best player. He was the best player. He was big and strong and athletic, but he was also technically very gifted. And coming to Tottenham probably was a kind of a rude awakening, because suddenly he's not the best in the group, and suddenly he's being told that, and he's being put under a bit more pressure. And I think he found it really hard, you know, really hard to cope with that, because he'd never experienced it. So he didn't have any coping strategies. You know, he's had a successful career, maybe not the same career as he would have expected in other people. And if you speak to him now, we learned some really invaluable lessons about him as a person and his motivations, but we just didn't know that at the time. And, you know, he had to move away and go abroad, and now he's back on loan at Forest and doing, you know, doing okay, and hopefully he'll push on from there. And he's the nicest guy in the world, and I think people always had a perception that he was just a big-time Charlie, and you couldn't be further than the truth. So, yeah, so I think there are kind of extremes, and, you know, for as many as I got right, and maybe that's more luck than judgment, lots of things went wrong. And I think mainly it was to do with probably those experiences that either you put in their way, you know, do you play them up, do you play them down, you know, all the problems with that. There's so many things. What loan do they go? Is it the right loan? What level of challenges have we just been talking about?
I think it's really interesting. So, you know, having spent time as head of education and working around football and some of the rugby players with yourself, Jamie, it's interesting to see that at that age group at 16, when they all move into digs, and especially in our environment, everybody moved onto the same campus. And I often have to speak to our coaches or the other staff about these young people, young players have come in, and all of them are the best in their head. And every different school they've been at, they're the best. And everybody's expecting them to be the best and to make it. The pressure on some of these kids is huge. And then you see them react in totally different ways. Some of them, you know, want to try and get to the top against each other, and some of them just disappear. It's a really interesting dynamic. How would you try and put that into perspective? As in, so you mentioned luck there, Rich, and are you strategically trying to pick these challenges for people, or is this something that's new and just been kind of started to be understood?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been some really interesting papers, and Jamie's is another example of that, where I think people are starting to understand kind of this whole concept of speed bumps in the road, or, you know, putting some things in the way, either artificially because it's not happening, or it happens naturally. And I know there's this whole thing around kind of trauma and needing trauma. And I think people misunderstood that, you know, you had to have in the family and all these things. And that might happen. That might be the thing that drives you forward. But there might be some kind of subtler things. And I guess what people are learning, and I think some places are trying to do, is what is that level of challenge? Is it from, yes, as you described, you've always been the best in the group. You've always been number one. But the one time when you're not the best in the group is when you go in the first team environment, and then you're the bottom of the group. And you've no idea how to cope with that. So is that playing a player up, or in a different group, or sending them to a different environment? You know, when you're at Disney World, which is Man City, Tottenham, Liverpool, all the best sides, how do you get them to prepare to go out on loan to Gillingham or Colchester? No disrespect to them. So we used to do things at Tottenham like, right, this week we're all going to train down at Dagenham and Redbridge. And where's my kit? Well, you pick it up, you take it, you wash it, you take it home. Where's my lunch? You know, go and find some. You're not getting it. You're going to go and have to work it out for yourself. So you'd put those things. Now, whether at that point it was, well, you know, this is some kind of real thought out strategy. Actually, to be fair, I think there was a little bit of thought behind it, because we realized that's something that they needed because of our experiences of people really struggling when they went out on loan. And I think more clubs are doing it, being more thoughtful. The problem is you can't just do it, and it's like teaching them to swim by throwing them in the swimming pool. People need support and help. So, you know, if you're going to move them around and up and down, I used to think I was a genius by moving players down an age group, because I thought that was the best thing for them. Years later, they said, you know, I'd have a conversation with somebody, and I went, no, that worked, and you've now made it all the way up here. I hated it. It was the worst experience of my life. I felt like I wasn't with my peers. I felt as though, a bit like at school when you sent down a class, I'm thick, I'm not good enough. And I thought I'd been absolute, you know, I hadn't considered some of the psychological issues. Now, again, maybe that helped drive them forward, but I don't know whether we supported them enough through that.
Just to build on that, one of the things that we put some emphasis on at Leicester and now at Loughborough is the idea of deliberately teaching psychological skills as well, so that you are equipping players to be able to cope when the challenge comes. And then, as Rich just pointed out, the idea of using speed bumps or testing those previously developed skills to then reinforce them. And ideally, if the key mechanism that we're pointing to is the idea that if people have experience negative emotion from challenge, then they'll probably reflect deeply on what's happened. And if they experience lots of positive emotion as a result of a challenge, then they'll likely reinforce their motivation, reinforce their confidence. And it's that tentative balance that moving through a player's journey is that ideally you want the fluctuation of that emotion, and that you don't have it for too easy for too long or too hard for too long.
And so what kind of things did you put in place, you know, at Loughborough or with Tigers?
So at Tigers, we implemented, a program deliberately teaching skills as players move through the pathway. And the difference with rugby and football is that football have smaller cohorts of players that tend to be a much better resource than rugby, lower down their pathways. In rugby, we implemented the deliberate teaching of psychological characteristics of developing excellence through the pathway, and then used strategic points to challenge them. And then as player numbers were reduced, the closer to the academy they became, that became a little bit more bespoke. Now at Loughborough, what we're doing is looking at, again, the deliberate teaching of these skills, and we're going to be implementing different speed bumps and challenges for players, and particularly under the conditions that we're currently under, it's a perfect opportunity for players to develop different psychological skills.
So specifically as an example of a speed bump and then the skill that you're trying to develop, have you got examples of that?
So this is interesting because ultimately what's perceived as a speed bump might, by one person, might be the complete opposite for another. So for example, one player getting the move up to go and train with the first team for a week, it could be the best thing that's ever happened to them. They get a couple of lucky breaks in training and their confidence is boosted. They get to know players and they get a bit of acknowledgement. Another player who drops the ball or puts a bad box kick up has a terrible experience of the whole week. So ultimately, it's just a difficult balance, because what you try to implement might not actually happen. But those are the typical kinds of things that can be deployed. So that could be playing up, it could be playing down, it could be being dropped. Those are the sorts of things that can be used.
And what kind of psychological skills do you try and train them in, or are you trying to allow them to kind of develop skills themselves through those experiences?
So I suppose I'd emphasize the need for skill development prior to a challenge, because we don't want this to be a sink or swim activity where we just chuck people in the deep end and if they sink, well, that's their problem. That's not, I don't think that's necessarily ethical or high quality talent development practice. So in order to cope with a challenge, we know that ideally you need to be highly committed. And there's ways in which you can reinforce commitment through coaching, whether that is focusing on somebody who is highly committed, whether that's role modeling commitment through an academy, and also the idea of proactive coping, which is you teach people coping skills, you talk through experiences of others, how would you cope with this when it happens, and so on.
Have you had similar things in football, Rich? Do you put these similar road bumps in place and develop psychological skills before and after? So I think, as Jamie mentioned, I think previously it has been a sink or swim culture in some environments.
Yeah, no, I mean, similarly, I think, as I say, clubs are getting much better at understanding what the requirements are and having the right people with the right levels of support. Because again, I think it's great if I come up with a strategy, but then, you know, who's going to support them through that? And the individual nature of it, you know, it can't do it en masse necessarily. You find that completely so far apart in terms of where they're at. It is really interesting though, because, you know, certain clubs will have a reputation for having good pathways, i.e. people can see a way into the first team. Some haven't. You know, you've got the experience now at Chelsea whereby the fact that they had the rule break or whatever, and that they have a registration ban, suddenly they have loads and loads of good players. A third of England's players come from Chelsea, but they didn't have a pathway, so they were all out on loan. And so suddenly they haven't got any choice. Plus they've got a manager that's been working with some of them. And guess what? They go through and flourish. But I think that the knock-on effect to that is sometimes lower down the pathway, people then assume that it's easy to get into the first team. So I know it happened at Spurs. Everybody said, oh, it's really good now. It's easy, isn't it? You can get everybody through because you've got a manager in Pochettino at the time who's going to accept them through. Do you know what? Yes, they may have had more opportunities to get in front of the manager through training, but more were rejected through this notion of character. It wasn't a technical ability or physical attributes. It was they weren't able to train at the levels consistently for the manager to trust them. So he would, and he was quite clever, he would say things like, oh, that player's lazy. So the player could hear it. The player would come and say, what does he mean? I'm lazy. I'm working my socks off. No, it doesn't mean you're lazy. It doesn't mean you're getting out of bed at 11 o'clock in the morning and not doing stuff. It means that look how Harry's working, look how so-and-so's working, that's the level you've got to do it. Anything lower than that, he'll think that you're not really able to work hard enough, then you get rejected and pushed back. And then I guess it's how you're supported through that to get back up in front of him again, rather than thinking, I've done it. And to be fair to him, he was forgiving, in as much as, you know, if somebody then showed the right characteristics, he would keep them in the group. So he'd keep some and not others, and people would go, well, but he's better than him and he's better. But that wasn't really the point. It was how you were able to cope in that environment, and ultimately for a first team coach to trust you. And there were loads of examples where young players, Oliver Skip, you know, comes on in the last 2 minutes or 3 minutes of a local, you know, like a game against Arsenal when it's tight. And in the old days, you just never have done that. You wouldn't have tried. They obviously had that trust.
And do you, in terms of those situations, those scenarios that happen, that training that you put in place, is this giving them the ability to kind of self-reflect on things? Is it through somebody helping them through that and a coach kind of reflecting with them? Where are you with those kind of stages?
Yeah, I suppose for me, the kind of the whole self-reflection bit is a bit that I think football is kind of learning now. And I think more within academies, EPPP, you know, I've seen many more presentations by players reflecting back on performance, setting goals, you know, that whole thing. And people have become quite competent at doing that. You know, self-reflective journals were a thing that you'd never have in football. You know, what have I done today that was going to help me be where I want to get to? Normal in other sporting arenas, but not within football. I always used to notice if you went past the analyst room at the old training ground at Tottenham, you know, Luka Modric will be in there looking at his, you know, his clips, but nobody else. English players just didn't do it. They didn't have that in them. So I think there is starting to be at that top level things put in place to make sure that players are starting to reflect on their own performances, and then skilled coaches working alongside them to help them through that, rather than just saying, well, you get on, do it. Obviously you need support, advice, you know, pointers, whoever that might be, and having enough people around them, whether it's psych people, whether it's physical development people, whether it's, you know, technical coaches or tactical sort of stuff as well. So I think people are getting better at it. I think if you go lower down, then probably where there's less resource, maybe it's harder, and you get back to the old days of I'm the coach, I have to be an expert at everything. And some people are really good at that as well, by the way, and have done really good jobs. But I think it's obviously a little bit more difficult at that kind of lower level.
I'd agree with Rich. I think there's some really interesting and very high quality work that's going on in football academies in that regard at the moment. And I would agree in that, I suppose, the period of time that I've been involved in working in football academies, that there's been quite a significant shift, and that's maybe only in the last 5 years. I think that there's an interesting bit for the coach here in how they operate and how they treat, the idea of what's athlete-centered, and in terms of developing decision-makers. And I think that coaching practice as a whole can do something a little bit more subtle when it comes to developing decision-makers on and off the pitch, thinking about self-reflection, thinking about the decisions that they make that don't just happen when they step on the grass. So, for example, a coach who's working or offering feedback to a player or to an athlete, if they see that as a two-way process and not just a one-way thing, and that happens almost right from the start when a player with a young player, they're then going to start developing the self-reflection skills. They're then going to start developing the decision-making skills that we so often really prize very highly, but often don't pay deliberate attention to the development of from an early stage.
So what has changed in both rugby and football? What's developing? And then what can we do more? So looking probably more at that systems approach, and how can we bring this in better?
So from my point of view, one of the real challenges on the horizon for rugby is that the elite game is getting further and further ahead of the rest of the game. There is a real challenge for the talent development environment or the academy seeking to prepare players for that next step up, because it is getting so much harder. The quality of the game at the top level is becoming so much better. And therefore, certainly to my mind, there's a real challenge for academies in preparing players for what that is like, particularly as for most rugby players, the level of competition they're exposed to for a long period of time is relatively low, and it's very easy to dominate. And yet when it gets tough, it gets really, really tough. So I think that's an area that all rugby talent development needs to have a very close look at.
Yeah, I mean, I think similarly in some ways, you know, we'll see what happens coming out of this kind of period of time. But, you know, the Premier League is incredibly financially rich and can take any player in the world. So, you know, pathway is always an issue. And I said about the Chelsea, you know, the amount of players that they have in their system, that when I was working with the FA, it was a problem. You know, we were investing lots of money in those young players with no prospect of them necessarily getting to the top part. So if you want England to win World Cups, it's really hard when you've only got, what, 33% English qualified players playing in the Premier League. And, you know, that takes into account the whole spectrum from, you know, the top teams all the way down. There'll probably be more in some of the lower down teams. You know, you'll find that some of those teams in the bottom six will have more English players than perhaps in the top six. But you need your players to be playing Champions League football. You need them to play Europa League football at least. You know, you need them to be training on a day-to-day basis with the best players in the world. And I think, thankfully, Chelsea has been an example now where it's helped. You know, can they do it at Man City? That's really hard when you can get any player that you want in the world. You know, how does Phil Foden continue to develop? You know, what are the things that he needs to do to become a top player? Manchester United have always had a good track record, but, you know, and Tottenham, yes, they did, but now how will that go with a new manager? Who knows? So I think pathway is always is a massive issue. And then how you know, as you say, how you prepare players to be able to step into that environment. And, you know, when the manager's only going to keep his job for, you know, every three or four games, he's under pressure. the risk of playing a young player that you're not quite sure about and exposing him to those things is risky. And I understand why they don't do it. And therefore, you know, they'll go with the tried and tested, or they'll want to go and spend money and buy somebody from somewhere else. So I guess that's going to be the biggest challenge, I think, going forward, as it has been for a number of years.
I think that's really interesting, because at that top level, it seems, you know, it's really difficult to control that. But that lower level, that slightly earlier piece that Jamie touched upon, I think that's interesting in regards to the grassroots side and the link there. So just a question on that, I suppose. At what age do we see these kind of things happening? So if you're pulling in a player at 14 from grassroots, is that still happening now? Or are players going through academies just in the academy the whole time? And what benefits might you see of them dropping in and out of these academies?
But I think that's the natural way, isn't it? I mean, we talked about it not being linear. You know, you have people that will come in early and go all the way through. So Ollie Skip at Spurs has been there since 7. He's gone all the way through. But you're going to have other players. Jamie Vardy's going to come in, go out, come back in again. You know, there's going to be a whole raft. And that's the problem. Most people's pathways are different. And they're not all the same. So I guess you still do. I mean, the net in football is spread so low that it's unlikely that you haven't had some kind of contact with an academy. We had Stephen Corker at Spurs, who hadn't been anywhere. And at 15, he came into us, only having played for London Inner Schools. He'd been to one trial at Reading as a left winger, and he was going to go to Southampton the next day, and we signed him the same night as he came in. That is unusual. The kind of Ian Wright syndrome of people just not being there and suddenly finding them is unusual, but it's, you know, you can't dismiss it. So I'd always say, you know, you've got to be an open-minded, because when I worked in professional football, people said, oh, it's too late, 15, too late, you can't come in. It's got too much to do in a too short period of time. But actually, they brought a whole different level of knowledge, skill, experience, which was probably quite beneficial in terms of they didn't take it for granted. They had to work hard. They were used to it being rough and ready. The pitch never bothered them. And they kind of got on with it. Were they used to the intensity of training? Probably not. Did their body sometimes give out on them a little bit and they had to? Yes. But if you stuck with them, they did bring something very different and added to the group.
Is that similar in rugby, Jamie?
Yeah, very much so. And every sport will be quite individual in the way that players come in and out. But I think, and I suppose outside of rugby, even I was watching a programme on the NFL last night where one of the top draft picks barely scraped into a very moderate college and then didn't even start playing any decent American football until he was in his final year at college. And yet ends up being one of the most highly recruited players to come out into the NFL. Ultimately, things happen at different stages to different people. And those pathways look different in lots of sports. I think the key thing for all sports to bear in mind is what are the entry and exit routes and how often, how frequent are they? Because we know that talent can develop at different stages. And as a result, sports need to cater for that and not put in artificial barriers like the one that Rich just discussed at 15. They're not going to make it after that.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting point and probably a good place to kind of finish or conclude on. It's been really good chatting to you and getting some insights into this. And you can obviously see the psychological aspects that challenge players. If there was one piece of advice you would give to a player or let's say a club, what would it be regarding this talent ID and systemizing this pathway?
So from my point of view, it would be make sure you're taking a deliberate approach to the teaching of psychological skills through a pathway and don't ignore the importance of challenge variables.
Yeah, I mean, I just think people have to understand the complexities of what we're dealing with. So it's not a given. And everybody's pathway is very, very different. So, you know, you've got to give players time. You know, we're too time bound and we want to make decisions. You know, I think the best strategy with young players is to get as many as you can and keep them for there as long as possible without making a decision. And then clearly having the support systems in place to be able to develop them on an individual basis. And that individualism is really important, because we're typically in football, we do everything as a collective. It's the whole group, you know, and we all do the same physical out things. We do the same technical things. We do the same tactical things. Getting better at it, but how can we break it down to make sure that it's more individualised?
Guys, I think that's really, really brilliant and really, really timely on what you've been through. I think we could go into so much detail on every single element of this. So I know we're just scratching the surface, but really appreciate you both coming on.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch and let us know any subject areas or experts that you'd be keen to listen to, then contact me, Martin Foster, on m.foster@alborough.ac.uk. Bye for now. We'll see you next time.